Hi folks, how you doing? I hope you're well. Thank you so much for choosing to listen to this episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Very much appreciate it. Last week on the show, if you were listening, I teased a little bit of information about the BAFTAs. So I thought I would share that information with you if you didn't already hear. But myself and Mr. Dermot O'Leary are going to be hosting the actual BAFTA Awards this year. I am beyond excited. It means the world to me, and I can't wait. Sunday the 11th of April, we are going to be on BBC One bringing you the awards. Oh my God, can't believe it's happening. Anyway, let's get on to some more pressing matters. And our latest episode of Soundtracking sees us joined by an incredibly prolific composer who currently has, well, a couple of very exciting projects for you to feast your ears and eyes on. Henry Jackman's latest work can be heard on Apple TV's Russo Brothers film Cherry and Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which is streaming weekly on Disney+. Loving Falcon and the Winter Soldier. We just watched the second episode of it. It's dropping every Friday on Disney+. I don't know, I'm just really happy and enjoying all these wonderful kind of character studies that they're doing, you know, as they make their way through these brilliant characters that have been around for so long when you think about it, and how they've stood the test of time, and how Kevin Feige and his brilliant team at Marvel have just created this, I think, brilliant world. And I know that my family and I are thoroughly enjoying everything they throw our way, so keep it coming. We've got Loki to look forward to in June as well, can't wait for that one. And Cherry, which is Anthony and Joe's film, and it's got a really personal connection for them in relation to their own personal experience of losing someone to opioid addiction, and also it's based and set in their hometown, so it's got a real personal touch to it, and I think the emotion really shows through. I think the way that they've visually chosen to represent and tell this film is brilliant, and Tom's performance is extraordinary, as is Henry's music. And he is an absolute joy to spend time with. But before we speak to him, a word from our good friends at sofa.com. Now, when it comes to watching films and TV, I genuinely think that one of the most important things that can enhance the experience is having the perfect sofa to snuggle up on. And that's where sofa.com come in. A premium brand that makes beautiful, comfortable, handmade products. They are the perfect choice to help you create your perfect sofa. First, you could choose your ideal shape. You might want something traditional, or maybe go for something a bit more contemporary. Then you've got to work out the size. You'll find the perfect fit, whether the space you have is cozy or sprawling. And then when it comes to fabrics, you really are spoilt for choice, with hundreds of options to style things your way. Now, finding it hard to decide on colours and textures, well, why not order a few free fabric swatches to match colours with other furniture or decor? What's not to love about your sofa being handmade to your specific requirements, especially for you, and delivered right to your door? To find out more and begin creating your dream sofa, simply visit sofa.com. And so to Henry. Now, unfortunately, his score for Falcon and the Winter Soldier has yet to be released, so we will edit in the relevant cues if and when they become commercially available. Thankfully, though, the fantastic Cherry score is available via our good friends at Lakeshore, and it's with a cue from that we begin Triangle of Death. Thank you.
How's it going?
Really good. Thanks so much for doing this, Henry.
That's all right.
It's really interesting when I've been looking back at some of the directors that we've had in the past on the show, and you've featured really heavily.
Oh yeah.
Since we launched back in 2016, so it's great to finally get you on. Let me repeat what I was saying earlier, which was, as well as having this brilliant collection of films that I've talked about on the podcast, when I kind of sit down and look at the list of films that you've worked on, specifically around in this past year, the films that my kids and I have gone back to watching again. I've got two boys, 8 and 12.
Oh, okay.
You have filled our world. I mean, I would say weekly, with everything from Wreck-It Ralph, Puss in Boots, Detective Pikachu. Oh, I mean, just the most amazing collection. Big Hero 6. Oh my God, that film.
That was a really cool movie, that. I'm surprised they didn't make another one. It's really good.
Me too. And I hadn't watched it in a long time, and we sat down and watched it again, and it is the most beautiful film. I loved it. Loved going back to, and it really stands the test of time. And I always think it's the same with those films. You kind of, there's layers to them. So the more you watch them, the more you kind of reap the benefits of, almost in a way as well.
Oh, for sure. Well, yeah, if the movie's got any content, if it hasn't, each viewing will only reveal how awful it is.
Painful.
Yeah, exactly.
I also had the pleasure of doing a remote Q&A with the Russo brothers and Tom and Sierra.
Oh, wow.
About a month ago for Cherry. Massive congratulations on the score and the music for that film, because it's such an important part of the narrative, really, in terms of understanding this character.
I think, yeah, that was probably the most, everything about doing the score for Cherry was a bit very peculiar in a good way. You know, like the whole process of it was like being a mad professor locked in a laboratory for 6 months, just sort of being experimental.
Oh, wow. Did they encourage you to do that, or was that something you felt it needed from reading the script?
COVID kicked in, so I wasn't going anywhere. I mean, it probably would have been a bit like that anyway. It was more like being an odd recording artist than a, you know what I mean? It was a bit like being a cross between like Aphex Twin, Vangelis and Radiohead, you know, and making an album rather than, you know, because it didn't really have any symphonic. I mean, I love big symphonic scores, but Cherry was a totally different animal.
I'd go and see that band live, though, that crossbreed, for sure. That would be an amazing gig.
Yeah, that would be. Like, I'd throw Late Talk in there.
Ooh, lovely.
You know, like Spirit of Eden, and they made some really cool. It's actually, just throwing those names out, that wasn't accidental, actually, in that, you know, Brian Eno, Vangelis, And those two bizarre talk albums called Spirit of Eden and Laughing Stock are really cool. Anyway, so yeah, Cherry wasn't so much like a big symphonic score and felt more like, you know, because there's a lot more production and engineering and going round and round, just craft it. It's a slightly different technique. It's a slightly different process to, you know, if you're writing a big Kong Skull Island,
yeah,
for a 4-minute cue, that's a big symphony. It's a different kind of composition. Whereas it kind of brought me back to my record industry days in a way, Cherry, because it was a bit more like making an album.
Yeah. Was that pretty obvious to you that it was going to be a particular type of score that was required for this film once when you read the script? And were there conversations that you had with Joe and Anthony about it?
Yeah, we definitely had conversations about it. They were extremely excited because, you know, it was their first big directorial thing since Avengers. And it was obviously going to be a completely different type of filmmaking to the successful, you know, superhero stuff that they'd been basically conquering the world with. Yeah, I don't think I knew exactly what I was going to do until I saw the first cut. And to be honest, it's deceptive to say I knew exactly what I was going to do. It was seriously experimental. When I saw the first cut, the basic vibe was, let's do something really eclectic. But due to the nature of the movie, it's going to have all sorts of flavors and tones and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I was up for the eclecticism. But then the other thing is that, well, you know, what we don't want is a score where people go, hey, this is interesting. It's got all these like cool, completely different pieces, but ultimately it's just a total dog's breakfast. And doesn't really add up. So what I wanted to do, I don't know if I've got a piano sound here. The one thing I remember coming up with after seeing the first cut, I don't know why things work. Yeah. This thing that went. It's the last cue in the. And I had this. This tune sounds truly terrible.
It's so beautiful.
Well, I don't know about that. It sounds a bit crap on the piano. But I had this basic theme because I wanted to make sure that amongst all the various different colours and all the different things the movie had to do, there would be some sort of coherent DNA that could be twisted and used so it doesn't just feel like, you know, all kinds of craziness. I mean, there was other things. Another thing was the idea of the Carnival of Losers. For his like Cherry's kind of sad, messed up life, that yeah. Was a bit witty because instead of being some grungy band thing, we went the opposite way, made it like a Chopin-esque kind of
yeah, like a Chaplin, like almost kind of like a Chaplin film.
Yeah, you know, while they're like smoking weed in the back of a car and arguing about joining the Marines and stuff like that. Yeah. Meanwhile, you're getting this like Eric Satie meets Chopin type of. What, like, and I sort of made sure the tune kept going downwards to signify that it's heading downwards, just like their lives.
That's so clever though, because when you know, when you listen to it, you connect with it, but when you talk about it, it's so interesting to think about the thought process that has got into the relevance to that, to the story and the narrative.
Well, it's interesting you said that. Obviously, when people watch a movie, you know, you don't want them to do any of that. But for anyone who's like interested in the, you know, filmmaking process, it's one of those things where hopefully by the time you watch a movie, everything's so nailed, it just becomes this homogenous experience, not comprised of its, you know, component parts. you can almost be deceived into thinking it was sort of, it came out of the womb like that. And as soon as you get interested in filmmaking, you find out the endless hours of people's lives that go into, and not just me, you know, meaning I think what the picture editor went through and the costume people and the cinematographer and the edit and the directors and the pre-print, it's just like, once you start finding out, you know, how the city of Rome was built, it does become quite interesting. But the funny thing about Cherry was I just sort of didn't get straight into the individual scenes and the cues. I wrote the piece that on the soundtrack is the second to last track, you know, the big long one called The Come Down.
Mm-hmm.
Before I got into individual pieces, I just wrote a standalone, like 7-minute suite called The Cherry Suite, which had all those big synths and the tune that I was playing and the little piano thing. You know, so I just wanted to explore that thing. So I wrote that and they really seemed to respond to that. And I was like, well, look, let's keep going in this, not knowing exactly what the music's doing and where for now. And I'll write another piece, which is the very last track on the soundtrack, called What I'm Trying to Say Is.
So good. I love the instrumentation of it. I just love the I love the choice of what's making the sounds.
Well, the choice, you say choice is quite accidental. Basically, due to COVID, I play the piano, right? And all kinds of production messing around. But, you know, I don't play the guitar. I've got no chops at all. So I filled the garage with a ukulele that was like a tourist purchase from the Cook Islands at the airport. A zither that my father gave to me that was missing two strings and was out of tune. An Andean harp that I physically myself managed to drag over from Peru in 1995. And most of whose strings are actually like cassette wire and it's completely out of tune. I just filled the garage with all the stuff and then dragged it in, set up a microphone and went, okay, I'll just, an Imbira, all these things I basically couldn't play, you know. And I just started putting this track together. And all the way through, I was thinking, I can't work out if this is one of the most embarrassing piles of crap ever written or whether it has something to it. And there's a keyboard thing that shows up halfway through that playing the chords, which was $4.99 from a thrift store. It's like the cheapest piece of crap you've ever seen. Like half of it, half the settings like didn't work. And so the whole thing was a bit of a Dr. Dolittle. So, you know, you can imagine when I first started putting the track together before it was, you know, properly assembled and I knew what I was doing with it, it was pretty embarrassing. Listen, you know, and I played it to my the music editor, Jack Dormer. I was like, I don't know. I think I should probably abandon ship, right? He said, no. I said, but listen to it. Not only is the instrumental playing like shockingly crap, you know, and I hadn't put it together yet. I'm not sure we should play this to Joe and Andy. He said, no, what are you talking about? And by the time I finished it, he goes, I think this might be the best piece you've ever written. I was like, Jack, you can't be serious. If you think about, you know, because I'm maybe a bit more, it's natural maybe to feel more proud or safe with things that are like virtual, you know, like, I don't know.
Yeah, Captain Phillips and all the big massive, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or like Captain America Civil War, something like that. Not this like half-assed indie thing where I'm not even confident I've managed to play anything very well. And Jack goes, no, but that's why it's so good. Because it's got this like weird vulnerability, because you're not, you know, completely in command of all these instruments. So it's really, really honest. I was like, okay, well, I have to trust you. So we played it to Joe and Anthony, and they were like, oh, this is so beautiful. It's perfect, because it's sort of like, it's naive and flawed and heartfelt, and this will be great for Emily and everything. So I was really glad I pursued it, but it did feel a bit like being totally exposed in every conceive. I mean, you know, just talk about, you know, because it's a different kind of, if when you're acting, especially in theater, it's a certain kind of vulnerability you have to accept in order to perform. It's slightly different as a composer, because once you finish, no one needs to see, you know, it's the music's like embedded in. But the whole experience of doing the score for Cherry definitely felt like extremely sort of exposed, because there was so much experimenting that you just keep thinking, well, maybe this is complete crap. We'll just have to find out when other people hear it.
Tom's performance influence or inspire you at all?
Oh, yeah.
Pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very good.
Oh, yeah. You don't, it's, I remember it sort of in a, probably wasn't supposed to, when I was about 14 or 15, I remember watching Angel Heart, which I guess in the UK would have been like 18. Right. So, but one of the things about it, you know, Rob De Niro was already a legend by then. I remember literally about an hour into that movie going, wait a minute. That Louis Seyfried, that's not Robert. Is that Robert? Nah, that's not Robert. Is that Robert De Niro? Because he'd sort of like, I know it's a cliche, because any decent actor should completely transcend any of their previous connotations and disappear into the character. But as we all know, you know, like Robert De Niro achieves that at some like epic level that seemed such, I mean, I literally didn't even realize it was Robert De Niro. And every now and then, you know, I'd be working, because I spent, you know, I'd start work at like 6 a.m. Every day I'd be working on this movie. And I just forgot. When people go, oh, isn't Tom good? I'd be Tom. Tom who? Tom what? Oh, yes, of course. It's, yeah. In the same way that I just was like, no, that's Louis Seyfried. That's not Robert De Niro. That's like, so the compliment is he's so invisible, you know, as any other thing, that I sort of stopped thinking he was doing a great job, because he just was Cherry. And I couldn't really conceive anything other than Cherry, which I, you know, as a cliche, isn't it? It's the ultimate. But one of the secret codes we found to the music was to, so strong was his performance and so central, given that the movie covers a lot of distance, a lot of time, a lot of location, a lot of different things, never abandoning his point of view and sticking with him musically was always the move. So a good example of that is, you know, when you first cut to the Iraq stuff, you've got big posh chopper shots of military hardware and sand dunes. You know, we've seen that before. It's kind of, you know, it looks epic, and it would be tempting to do like a big establishing, you know, imagine the sort of cue you'd get in a Michael Bay movie or in like Black Hawk Down, when you get like the big desert shot and the military hardware, and that would speak to like a sort of third party viewpoint of like big movie, change of location. It would sort of be playing a cue for the environment. And if you listen to that key, that first key when you see Iraq, it's so not like that. It's like across, it sounds a bit like that talk Radiohead-y kind of vibe. It's, meaning the reason that's important is that music's not saying, now we head into like a war movie about Iraq. What it's saying is, now Cherry having made the decision to join, you know, as in the Marines as a doctor, now he's off. So it doesn't, you don't lose him. It doesn't suddenly become this big, you know, and it's certainly not some geopolitical movie about like, you know, there's no stuff about whether it was a good idea for the Americans to be in Iraq or any politics. So all it is following the story of a guy who has left Cleveland and now finds himself in this environment, and it never lets go of Cherry. And we found that was the key with the music. Don't start playing environment and any kind of grandeur or judgmental third party commentary on the situation. Just stay with Cherry. That's what I tried to do with the music, and that's why it goes on quite a journey, you know, because by the time you get to the PTSD and the OxyContin and the bank robberies and whatnot, you know, that sort of Chopin ditty has turned into a kind of drug fueled, you know, all the sounds are getting bendy and messed up. You know, so that really, so when you ask, was it, the answer is absolutely, you know, I would say the score tracked the character maybe more than any score I've done, because, you know, with a more of a blockbuster thing, you're going to have cues that come out of characterization and speak to other like omniscient things. Whereas this really kind of stuck to Cherry.
Which is quite a unique thing as well. But it's like, it's really interesting with your relationship with the Russo brothers and working with them on, you know, the Captain America films, and then coming round to working on Falcon and Winter Soldier, which I watched. I was privy to the first episode last night. So me and my two boys.
Oh, wow. I'm amazed you did that without needing to be shot.
Well, I mean, I know I had like 55 million codes to kind of, like, I had 3 seconds to get these codes in the computer before.
Wow, you know, rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm this whole Disney Plus stream of incredible content that, you know, that they're making, that we're being fed, the, you know, Mandalorian, WandaVision, we've just eaten it up. It's been incredible, and particularly with lockdown and stuff, it's been so nice to have something to look forward to every week. You know, that we can wait for a Friday for it to come on, like the old days, you know what I mean? When you'd have to wait for things.
Yes.
I wondered whether, having worked on, you know, Captain America, and obviously, you know, Bucky being part of that story and his character and his story and that kind of coming through into Falcon and Winter Soldier, and very much from that first episode, I'm not going to go into any detail about it because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who won't have seen it yet, but whether that helped in a way that you had the the experience of that world?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. In what way?
Well, I mean, it would just be like, I'm trying to think of an analogy. It would be like if you've spent 3 years in India and then I suddenly put you in charge of like some quite important company or something. And instead of landing in India going, wow, what the hell's going on? You'd be able to focus on whatever that appointment was, because instead of needing about 3 months to get your head round in, you say, no, I used to live here. You know, it's somewhat similar in that. Had I never been involved in the MCU, I guess I'll just have to do a lot of research. But the fact is, if you know the arc of Bucky and what happened to Bucky and the story of Captain America and the story of Falcon, it just means you're sort of setting off where you last left off. And it means you have an insight. Now, the thing is, without giving stuff away, it's actually going to move in quite a different direction. But just having the backlog of understanding of the MCU universe and having also created, apart from else, there are some themes that become handy to modulate and morph and work with in the new environment. So yeah, that's not to say anyone coming into the MCU universe who hasn't been in it, you know, that doesn't mean it doesn't work, but certainly it's such a sprawling and awesome universe. There's a lot of new stuff, you know, so it's good to be able to have an instinctive understanding of the history of some of these characters. I mean, I got so geeky with when I did the Winter Soldier, because for some reason I'm really interested in politics. I've no idea why. I mean, there's absolutely no way I will ever do anything professional in that. But I've always found it interesting, just conceptually.
Yeah.
And when you look at the early Captain, I remember reading, you know, downloading on the iPad and whatnot, really early Captain America, and it's fascinating how a lot of those people who turn their nose up, you know, you shouldn't call them cars, but, you know, graphic novels, all the superhero universe, should think twice. Because actually, if you were going to do a serious examination of American political history, you should include superhero graphic novels, because they basically track the political and like philosophical viewpoint of America. Meaning, when you read the original Captain America, they're hilarious. They're like government propaganda magazines where, you know, Captain America approaches like an eight-year-old child going, do you know how to spot a communist? Allow me to help you. You know, if you see a communist, you must report them to the government. And it you know, it's like straight up 1950s propaganda in which Captain America is like an unambiguous sentinel of liberty and freedom. And there's no self-doubt about the supreme moral ascendancy of America and how bad the communists are and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when you read Captain America from the 70s, you know, and Vietnam's kicked in, he's got a beard, he's disillusioned, he's drinking, he's like completely out of sorts with the American government. He doesn't believe in the wars that they're prosecuting. And it's like, oh, look, all that's happening is however American society feels, you know, it gets reflected in one of its most iconic superheroes. So, you know, it's a bit like instead of reading Greek mythology from thousands of years ago, it's like a mythology that's being updated in real time.
Yeah.
And reflects values, you know, and some of those are encouraging values. Like, you know, I can't remember exactly what the statistics are, but, you know, like Black Panther must be one of the most commercially successful films with an all African-American cast or black cast or whatever. So that, you know, that's an example of things shifting, a universe which is accommodating things that are evolving now in our society and about time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I only mention that because some people like to be quite snooty.
Yeah.
They should think twice about that, because especially, you know, with the Russos, if you look at Captain America Winter Soldier, there's the whole layer of what I'm talking about in there. I mean, you can enjoy it. It's a great movie anyway, to do with the action and the mystery of what happened to Bucky and the Winter Soldier and all the rest of it. But there's a whole layer in there to do with a libertarian thinking Captain America who's been in ICE, who, when he returns in 2012, suddenly finds that things are a lot more ambiguous and shaky and not the kind of world that he understood, where the Nazis are the bad guys and the Americans are the good guys. And then meanwhile, his own government seemed to be developing some like preemptive system to take out threats before they've even actually manifested, leading to like a sort of philosophical debate about, like, well, wait a minute, you know, it's like the pre-crime in Minority Report. Yeah. You know, that's all in there. And same in Civil War. Captain America Civil War has a whole thing to do with, like, well, wait a minute. I know we try to help out. And, you know, as superheroes, we do the best job we can. But the thing is, there is quite a lot of collateral damage. And, like, I don't know. We're not actually part of the US government. So, like, to whom should we? Maybe we should be answerable. Maybe there should be some sort of, like, UN you know, whatever. I'm saying it's got these various things that if you want to go there, you could actually think about. It's not all, it's not infantile in the way that some slightly unthinking people who are critical of it would think.
There's a scene in the first episode of this series where Sam goes to the bank with his sister to try and get a loan. And, you know, the bank manager's going, so how does your money come? Does Tony Stark, did he leave you some cash and all this kind of stuff? And it's kind of like me and my kids had about a 20-minute conversation out of the back of that, of them going, where do the Avengers get their money from? And all this kind of stuff. It was really fascinating in terms of, even with that first episode, it feels like it's kind of, it's really humanizing these people, you know, and I love that.
Yes. Well, you mentioned before, and it's a salient point that, you know, like when you have a movie, you've got to cram everything into this epic arc that's going to last between 2 and if it's Avengers Endgame, 3 hours. But whereas when you have this other format, you know, which is like 6 slots of an hour, it gives you a slightly different character development opportunity, because, you know, it's not the same as, it's not like you have a 6-hour movie, it's different structure, but because you've got those 6 hours, you can start exploring backstory and grounding things and making them quite realistic and psychologically credible in a way that, you know, you haven't got time. You've got to squeeze in a whole story and all the MCU characters in 2 hours 25 minutes, you might not necessarily get the time to do that. And that, and I think Marvel and, you know, Kevin and the directors in this one and in all these newer Disney formats, it's been quite clever in, you know, it's just a slightly different, it's like a zip file that's sort of unpacking in a slightly different way to the feature films. And I think it's really smart, rather than the fact that no one can go to the cinema, rather than seeing that as some sort of restriction, they've been really clever in celebrating this different format, adapting it, and playing to its strengths in a different way.
Yeah. I was surprised when you mentioned earlier that you don't play the guitar, because there's a great cue in this first episode where Sam arrives at the jetty where the boat, where his family boat's parked up and his sister's. And there's this great cue there that's kind of got, is quite kind of guitar laden. You surprise me.
Well, I write that using samples, and it's the same piece, but my God, it doesn't sound very good because it's all samples. And then that's played by, he's actually a great composer, but he's a brilliant guitar player, Alex Belcher. I then go, Alex, will you do me a favor and play this? And so my writing, if you'd heard that in the original sampled form, it's you know, you can hear that it's a decent piece, but it's pretty awful to listen to. And then it just gets this whole great layer of performance courtesy of Alex.
Great cue. And I also love, there was another one that really stood out as well, where Bucky's in his therapy session.
Oh, yeah. See, that's something you don't normally get. There's no way you would get Bucky in a therapy session in Captain America Winter Soldier, you know.
I love and I love the relationship with his therapist, where she, like, just every time she grabs her notepad and he's like, oh, really, the notepad? And it's just the tone of it from this first episode is just like, I can't wait to watch the rest of it, because it's just got a really interesting, you know, one minute you are kind of laughing and the next minute your heart's breaking with a character that Bucky's got a friendship with and you realize why. And you're like, oh, whoa. So there's I love this weight that it has in it, and the tone that it feels like it's going to have as well.
Well, exactly. And that, you know, it's also, that impacts the music. It's slightly different when you do, like, for example, Captain America Civil War, which was more orchestral than Winter Soldier because it was a bit more mythological, and it was almost like a proto Avengers movie, really. You know, by the time you get to the airport scene, it's kind of gods versus gods, you know. Whereas musically, it's an interesting one. There is orchestra, but it's not as epic as Civil War. Or it does, you know, sometimes, I mustn't give stuff away, it does get there. Mm-hmm. But in the way you're describing, you get these other scenes. You get scenes where, you know, Bucky's at the shrinks, and you get scenes where Sam's trying to sort out his, you know, more domestic ambitions, and he needs a bank loan and all this. So the music can enjoy some of these smaller, you know, it's not as obscure and sort of experimental, maybe, in the compositions, Cherry, but some of the scale and the intimacy of, you know, using just a bit more band elements and guitar and smaller scale instrumentation definitely shows up in the series. But, you know, having said that, in true Marvel fashion, there comes a moment, you know, when it all kicks off.
I mean, that first opening 10 minutes of Falcon in that kind of, you're like,
yeah, exactly.
This is amazing.
Right. It covers everything from it's, and the same with the music, it'll go as epic as the movies. But I think there's just more time to explore also the smaller instrumentation.
Yeah.
And more grounded, you know, less mythological and sort of, I don't know, less Wagnerian and slightly more contemporary as well. You get to do a bit of all of the above, you know, and that's one of the good things about the range that can show up in the, like I say, it's not really a 6-hour film, but given that you've got these 6 episodes,
yeah,
you know, there's a nice range to it, which they've really exploited in the actual, you know, filmmaking, as it were. So that then gets reflected in the music.
I mean, the range that you have as a composer and the range of films that you walk across as well is kind of, is, you know, is amazing. And I imagine a wonderful, you know, opportunity to be able to work across so many different types of films, you know, be it Captain America, Cherry, Man on a Ledge, you know, Kick-Ass, all that stuff. And then Big Hero 6 and Wreck-It Ralph and Detective Pikachu. I mean, an incredible mixture of films. Is that the attraction for you, of being able to kind of just go from, you know, right to left to up to down and all over? It's brilliant.
So. Well, everyone comes in different shapes and sizes. And of course, you get certain kind of artists and composers who are very much the opposite, you know, like they've established themselves maybe more from the world of the record industry, where they've got like a thing they do and it's so good they become like known for a specific thing. My journey into film music was like the biggest psychic relief of my life, right? Because this is going to sound really pretentious, but because I had such a diverse and unbelievably intense musical training, you know. So I went to St. Paul's Cathedral Choir School as a little, you know, baby chorus. I think I was 7 when I went to. So I was singing from 12th century to 19th century ecclesiastical church music in St. Paul's Cathedral, 3 hours a day for 5 years, and had, you know, so it's like the strictest. So I got familiar with Palestrina and Tallis and like, what, I won't bore your listen, but you know, extremely highbrow ecclesiastical music, right up to and including like Benjamin Britten and Penderecki and all this 20th century stuff. So I was part of something that was, I suppose, had to have the same like level of professional excellence as the London Symphony Orchestra when I was like 8 years old. So there was all of that, you know, and then I trained classically, and then I went completely off the rails, you know, abandoned all that, like the Vicar's Son rebelling. And then, you know, I was banging out two-step garage remixes and drum and bass, and then working in the record industry, trying to hide the fact I'd learned everything from Scriabin to Beethoven to, you know, Debussy and all the rest of it. So by the time I got to 30 years old, I knew quite a lot about plain song or church music or Bach or Mozart. Or Beethoven. You know, I've had to write string quartets in the style of Haydn. I love Stravinsky, but I also love like Fabio and Grooviner. It's just the biggest mess of stuff ever. So when I was trying to work in the record industry, I was like moderately successful, but I was always a bit like a cog not quite fitting in, because, you know, however cool the music, I mean, apart from stuff at the time, I don't know, like Björk, who's super creative, you know, it's always going to be about 3.5-4 minutes. You can't have millions of strange harmonies and chords and whatnot. I mean, there's all sorts of, there's loads of electronic and pop music I absolutely love. And I'm really glad I learned loads of techniques there, but I couldn't quite sort of put it all together. And then one day, for some reason, I was hanging out with Hans Zimmer by pure fortune. And I don't know why, I'd always thought of film music as something that like old fuddy-duddy people do. It's just like, I was like way too, trying to be too cool for school. And I suddenly realized, oh my God, the place where it doesn't matter that you know just as much about 14th century church music as like you might need a load of like electronica chops that sound a bit like Harold Budd and Brian Eno, or you might need some like beat programming that sounds a bit like DJ Hype or Grooveride or some dubstep, whatever, is film music. Because one minute you might be, you know, you might be doing some film set in, I don't know, it's like 16th century France about how the Huguenots got massacred by the Catholics. Or you might be doing a film set in 22500 and everything's techie as hell and you don't want any orchestra and everything, you know, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly having all these like disparate threads to your musical education, instead of sitting there chewing my fingernails going, I don't know, what am I going to do with all, you know, it suddenly, it doesn't matter. All it means is when you open the cupboard, instead of going, well, I got a red, I got a blue and I got a yellow, you go, oh crap, there's like loads of stuff. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to write good music. It just means that it was suddenly not a burdensome lack of focus to have been dancing around in so many different. And the thing is, my father was influential in that, because often what happens is people are into a certain kind of music, or they prioritize a certain kind of music. Whereas, without being pretentious, I genuinely love Benjamin Britten as much as, you know, like really good drum and bass. And it's just like, depending on what mood you're in, it usually people who are seriously classical tend not to have a strong interest in really heavy electronic genres, and people who are seriously into DJing and have a brilliant knowledge of the entire electronica thing from like late 80s Chicago house all the way through to now are unlikely to be prattling on, you know, about like Vaughan Williams. The two camps, it's not always true, you know, but the two camps tend to be a bit separate. Whereas I ended up with a foot in both camps, absolutely loving both, which was confusing for years until I got into film music, where I suddenly was really grateful that it was the world that accepts everything.
Yeah. I think it's funny, I watch my kids and I remember, you know, when you were growing up, you were into a type of music, you know. Oh, what are you into? And you would kind of sort of sit on, you know, on one kind of sort of pad of music, so to speak. But my kids don't think about music with genre. Genre is not important to them. It's not something they think about. And I think it's so healthy. And so much of that is because of film. You know, they'll connect with a piece of...
That's interesting. Yeah.
They'll connect with a piece of existing music, like one of the tracks from the Guardians of the Galaxy film or whatever. Do you know what I mean? One of those 70s tracks. They'll connect with that as much as they will.
They just feel, it's just instinctive.
It's an emotion. Yeah. It's a kind of, it makes them feel a certain way, as well as a piece of music within a film. I mean, they'll sit and they're always in charge of the music now when we're in the car or whatever, and they'll click on Spotify and they'll go to score sometimes. And my eight-year-old will tell me what's happened in the scene for this particular piece of music. It blows my mind that they pay that much attention.
Well, I mean, they've got you to thank for that. The thing is, we don't want to sort of descend into like a full Oxford style seminar, but the reason that there's two, or ascend or like side send.
Let's dance there instead.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing, because if you're a teenager and your parents have not exposed you, say, to film music, so you have this more eclectic range of music, which is obviously what your kids have, there's the identity version of music, meaning, you know, when you're a teenager, you've no idea who you are, you're confused, and to a certain extent the music, it's not really that people aged 14 are doing like a musicological breakdown of how, you know, how this thing's been put together. It's an identity thing. Like, you know, when I was a kid, some people were still, I thought I was super cool because like we hated guitars and everything was rave. We were all going to raves. No one cared. Like guitars were uncool. Rock music was uncool, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, a lot of these things are to do with clothes and identity. And it's it's like for the sort of psychic identity of someone who hasn't yet found themselves, to be able to like hang their hat on something.
Yeah, feel part of something, isn't it?
Yes, but that's actually a social phenomenon, not a musical. Now, what's happening with your kids, thankfully, is that because the range of stuff is so wide, you know, if you watch movies, you could hear anything like from some funk track from Guardians of the Galaxy. It's a massive sweeping orchestral track, which is maybe closer to a sort of 1920 Vaughan Williams piece. They're responding literally more to what the music's doing and not using it as a means of providing an identity for themselves. But I think one of the reasons I was so, apart from that, let me just move over here. One of the reasons I just never got like snobby about different kinds of music was I just really want to know how things work, you know, like a Swiss watch kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I promise, I had this one experience when I was at the cathedral choir. There's one piece, I think I was only about 9 years old, and there's one piece we were singing by Elgar, and literally all the hairs went up on the back of my neck, and it was just like this cosmic, I could not understand how this piece of music could, I mean, I was barely able to see. It was like electrifying. And at the end of it, when we finished the piece, I was like, I guess I'll never know why that happened. You know, why it was such an amazing experience. Yeah. And then I was thinking, well, hang on, that's not true. If I get the score, I'll learn, you know, I was only about 9, so it was a bit difficult to play. I was like, I could just figure out, you know, unlike trying to get the secret industrial secrets of like Chanel or Mars Bar or something, you know, music can't hide. So, and it was just this thing that went. it got to that bit, I was like, wow, that's good. So I learned, and then I started having this other thought, which is like, wait a minute, I should not just learn to play it like a piano player. I should sort of figure out the chords and then write my own half-assed rip-off piece, you know, meaning I figured out you can start bagging tricks. Like, why does this sound so cool? And so one of the reasons I was never snobby at music is like, once I start having had all this classical education, when I first heard like dance music, it started doing things like, I was like, no, that's the wrong chord. Right, you can't go C minor, F minor, B flat minor. That's like so incorrect, until I realized these DJ guys just sampled a chord and they were just hitting one key. So they were just going like, whacking, you know, one key. And instead of being snobby about it, I was like, well, I should figure out how that works. So every time I heard one of these, you know, every time I heard something that was very non-classical, instead of being snobby about it, it's like, well, you should figure out how it works. You should always figure out how it works. So I'd be sitting there at the piano going like, get it. So these are totally different, you know, you don't get chords like that in Beethoven or whatever. And then, yeah, exactly, you know, things like,
oh, lush,
right? And I'm like, oh, these are actually very cool chords. And in other words, all I'm saying is everything's worth checking out. So I think one of the reasons I ended up having quite a lot of different musical strands is there were very few things where I just would think, well, that's a lot of waste of time and there's no point finding out about it. I would hear something and go, and I'd hate the feeling of not knowing how they do that, basically. Mm. You know what I mean? Do you remember, you're probably a lot younger than me, there was some pop tune by Robbie Neville called C'est la vie.
Yeah.
It was late 80s.
Yeah, I remember it.
I was like, why is that so cool? Because I figured out pretty quickly the chords were just going. So I play on the piano, but it sounds crap. And I play on, but how come the record sounds so good? And then that was the beginning of me uncovering, like, oh, okay, so it seems like there's a whole lot of other stuff I got to learn. Meaning, if you just play the chords of a really well produced like pop track on a piano, that's not going to sound nearly as cool as the record, because the record has this whole new thing I didn't know about to do with like drum machines and engineering and synths and stuff. Okay, so now there's this whole, in other words, thanks to my father, who had a really eclectic attitude. Every time I stumbled across something like, ooh, hang on, so how do they do this? Instead of going, well, I'll stick, look, come on, I've already had the history of music from 1300 to 19, whatever. I don't need to do a whole, you know, I'd hate not knowing how things were done, you know, so I just.
That's great advice for anyone who wants to, you know, who wants to think in a
business. I disagree.
No, I think it's, you know, I mean, that's why I do this podcast, because I'm fascinated by the relationship that with pictures and music, you know, in terms of how it works and how it's created and the emotion it could convey. And
well, exactly. I mean, I've just been messing around with some like early 90s electronica, but it's the same thing with, if you're really interested on why things work, you know, if you're watching a movie and there's a cue that's really doing something, like, why is this so good? It's like, well, you know, it's not, you can find out by getting the score or like getting the track, listening to it. It's, I guess, I suppose it's like a version of a sort of scientific inquiry in a way. But anyway, the advantage of that is it sort of prevents musical snobbery. And I think, you know, I was really lucky to be a fly on the wall in a sort of Hans Zimmer universe for a little bit. I think as a mentor, he's very like, he's extremely unjudgmental. If you look at everything Hans Zimmer's done since he's started making music, he's so unjudgmental. He's done things like Da Vinci Code with these big and sort of brooding Wagnerian orchestra. He's done like the Joker suite from Dark Knight is like a million miles away from, you know, it.
Interstellar, oh, one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
Interstellar, like, which has like hints of Vavo Part and Estonian, you know, church music. He's incredibly eclectic minded and is neither judgmental in his approach to what a score needs musically, and is never judgmental about characters. I think one of the reasons Hans is such a brilliant composer is you'll get a layer, not of sympathy, but something like the Joker. The music for the Joker was so perfect for the Joker, and it didn't have any judgment in it about what a potentially appalling nihilist and a terrible character was. It's the, you know, it's finding out how to bring out a character without sort of finger wagging third party opinion showing up, letting go of yourself and inhabiting the story and the character, which brings everything to life. Let the judgment be made by the audience. Don't start laying, I mean, you know, it's not always, sometimes, you know, you want to do a cue where you have a very strong sense of, like, you know, evil or heroism or something. But I definitely learned something from the lack of judgment and the eclectic and very open mind. Because Hans, if you think about Hans, it's really similar. He's covered everything from giant orchestration to sort of minimal electronica without a second thought, you know.
But yeah, but you can, I mean, the similarities with you, that's the enthusiasm that you both have as well for what you do. It's like just, it's so inspiring hearing how much you love what you do. And you know, kind of just, it's so,
kind of similarities, because Hans is like the single most successful and like aesthetically influential film composer of the last, you know, however many years. I don't think I'm quite in that. I'm definitely in a lower order category than that. But we definitely are both enthusiastic and eclectic, I'd say that. But
yeah,
Hans is more like a game changer as well. No, Hans is important not just because of the music, more like a sort of black swan event, you know, a bit like Brian Eno. Brian Eno is just as important as like an influence as specific albums that he's made. I feel Hans is a bit like that, meaning something kind of shifted in film music. If you look at film music in its traditional sense, in the without any, you know, John Williams, an absolute genius. But if you think to an era of Alex North or John Willis, where something happens where the generation from Hans onward, of which I think Hans is definitely the strongest representative. It's like a sort of black swan event where something shifts in a big way that ripples on beyond just the actual music he's making. It's more like a sort of volcanic influence event. You know what I mean? And those come around. Those don't come around that often. You know, I don't think those sort of events don't really grow on trees.
I feel like we've only kind of skimmed the surface of the brilliant work that you've done so far. So maybe we can have another session at some point down the line, but it's...
I'm going to have to split. Yeah, well, my problem is I sort of waffle tangentially.
Oh, no, it's brilliant. I love it. You're the dream. But it's been so great to get to chat to you. You really, really has. And just, thank you as well, you know, from...
Well, that's not a problem. Can edit something together vaguely useful, and maybe I've got a few things going, but maybe we could do something where I talk a bit more about, you know, because I was looking on I was trying to find something on IMDb the other day, and I saw a list of everything I've done. I'm like, bloody hell, that is quite a lot.
Yeah,
because you don't when you're working it, you give everything so devotedly and exclusively to the thing you're working on.
Yeah.
It's a bit like burning your bridges as you go. You become, by the same token, you become committed to the thing you're doing. You sort of delete and forget everything that's gone before. So when you actually see it all in a line, you're like, how did that all happen? And you've sort of forgotten the processes that go into it, which I think is important because I think you have to let go very strongly. And that by the same token, that's the headspace. Yeah. That you freed up to launch into the next thing. But I'm no doubt I could fill up another hour of random prattling about things that I've actually done.
To date, I love it.
In the past.
Thank you so much for your time, Andy. It's a blooming treat to get to chat to you. It really is. Thank you.
No problem. Well, stay safe and we'll speak again.
To Falcon and the Winter Soldier, that's Louisiana Hero, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the fantastic Henry Jackman. My huge thanks to Henry for taking the time to talk to us. As I mentioned, you can watch Cherry on Apple TV with Falcon and the Winter Soldier available on Disney Plus. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll get Henry back again very soon to discuss his extraordinary back catalogue in more detail. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including my two conversations with the Russo brothers, as well as Black Panther director Ryan Coogler. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel where you'll find a wee show that I put together to accompany the podcast. We've got a new episode dropping over the next couple of days, which will feature Jamie Dornan, Steve McQueen and Dennis Bevel, and also the fantastic Morvid Clark, who of course stars as Maud in the brilliant Saint Maud. Now, before I let you know who's coming up next, just to give you an idea who we do have coming up over the month of April, because we've got a fantastic collection of nominated talents. We have Kevin McDonald talking about the Mauritanian. We have Chloe Zhao talking about the brilliant Nomadland. We have Emerald Fennell and Carrie Mulligan talking about Promising Young Woman. But next week, talking about this beautiful film that if you get the chance to see, it's called Minari. And I just absolutely adored this film. I thought it was absolutely beautiful. Lee Isaac Chung is the writer and director, and it's loosely based on his own experiences. We're very lucky that we have Emile Mossery, the composer of the stunning score for Minari, on the show. So I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.